This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg. With me this week are two amazing people, Nick White, staff contributor for comic books at Destroy the Cyborg, and Jeff Perry, friend of the podcast, host of the After Image podcast. Thank you guys for joining me this week. I'm so excited to have you here. That doesn't sound like I actually am, but I really am excited that you're here. How have comic books been? How have you guys been?
Comics have been great. Like, if it was like when they ask you how badly does it hurt on a scale from 1 to 10, if it was how much do you love comics, it would be like an 8.25. So it's good.
Oh, okay. That's good.
I've quantified my comic book experience because I realized that popular websites like IGN, this is how you make it. This is how you make it. You have to quantify things
right,
on a scale of 1 to 10.
They have to be able to graph it. I gotcha. What have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a pretty large amount of things. I've been trying to put a dent in that huge Aliens omnibus. It's like 500 pages. Four really long, different stories. But it's interesting. The art is so different across all four. And it sort of spans all the way from, I think, like the early 80s to the mid to late 90s, so the art quality and the print quality changes as well, so it's sort of fascinating to see that as well. So it's a little bit of a time capsule in addition, so that's mm-hmm. that's kind of neat. I read Bitch Planet number 5. That was pretty dark.
Yeah.
I feel like too much of the issue was spent trying to make one individual point. Can we make minor spoilers about this issue?
It's been out for 2 weeks, I think.
I feel like people who read that book are generally not behind on it. I mean,
sure, we can make that assumption,
seriously.
I guess.
Yeah. I thought that the whole, I forget what this sport of theirs is called. I don't remember. But
murder ball or something?
It might be like murder ball, but whatever this sporting activity is called, I felt the match at the end was far too drawn out to make the point that, you know, the deck is stacked against you, and we will do what we need to do to make you lose. You know, you might play the sport, but we make the rules.
Yeah, which has kind of been the theme for the whole book so far. But I think it's building. I mean, I won't hijack this, but my thought is that it's just building more towards the case of, like, there is not a win scenario for these women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. 100%. I mean, yeah, I agree with that. The ending was effective. The ending was shocking. From what I've been told and from what I've heard, there was a lot of discussion and debate over how to approach this issue. I mean, I think the reason we're getting it so late is because I think you told me even they sort of rerouted where the story was heading, the trajectory.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like the ending is very abrupt and jarring, and it's effective. So I thought that was good. I read Constantine the Hellblazer 4, which was another really interesting issue where the art has actually been a two-person collaboration for the second issue in a row. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you noticed that as well.
Yeah.
Sort of present versus past time. And I mean, I'm really loving this book. I think Vanessa Del Rey's artwork is fantastic. I don't know if I told you this, but Rossimo is actually coming back for 6 at least.
He'll be back. Gosh. Yeah. That's so exciting.
Which is not to say anything, you know, is wrong with Vanessa Del Rey's artwork. I still like her stuff. It looks a lot like Hit, which, I mean, that's her too, so maybe that's unfair. Your artwork looks like your other artwork, but
yeah.
No, I enjoyed 4. I really liked that it seems to be delving more into the original mythos of Hellblazer itself. There are little characters here and there and whatnot. And the artwork is fantastic. And like I've said before, as far as being a mature and dark comic, this is probably as far as DC can get. And I think that they're doing a really good job about being mature and dark and not falling on the gratuitous side of things.
And you got to love that it's so independent of everything else right now. And we've said this before on the show, you know, they failed at that with the previous Constantine.
Just Constantine. Yeah. No, it's amazing. And fingers crossed, I really appreciate the fact that this literally ties into nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Not even slightly. There's no other book that's been, like, mentioned. I don't think they've even gone so far as to even reference or mention any characters or events outside of this book. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I don't know if outside pressures are going to peek in at some point or another, but for right now, I'm happy with that. And the only other really big thing that I read was in anticipation for reading New Suicide Squad, which I recently picked up the trade of. I went back and reread Suicide Squad Volume 5, which is what plays into that book. And it's Matt Kent, and it's got a great Amanda Waller one-shot written by Jim Zub, which is also really, really good. And it's got Patrick Zercher on art, who is now the current Green Arrow penciler. And it was really enjoyable, a lot of fun, played with a lot of other more bizarre characters that maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with, like OMAC. I think I sent you that bizarre picture of Harley Quinn and OMAC, and OMAC is in this, and it was a lot of fun, and I'm really interested to see where New Suicide Squad goes, because I think Harley Quinn got pulled off of that book when New Suicide Squad launches. So yeah, gotcha. that's what I've been reading. What cool. about you, Jeff?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that comics have been good, and if I had to put mine on a letter scale, I would give it a B+.
Okay.
Sorry, keep going. I'm so excited for what my rating scale is going to be after this. So
I hope it shakes.
Jeff.
I hope it's like Arrested Development, where maybe gets a rainbow sticker from her like progressive liberal school. Yeah. She got a rainbow in math. Is that good or whatever it is? Anyway,
I didn't have a whole lot of time this week to read comics, but I read Prez number 1-3, which I think is the latest one that came out. I went into it thinking that this is going to be a really bad book, because immediately after I picked it up, I think it was Mike that told me that like this book isn't great, or like you've heard nothing but bad things about it or whatever. And I read it and I, at face value, it's a horrible book. But if you look at it as
how do you turn this boat around? But okay,
go ahead.
Instead of it being like this really weird world of like Twitter being allowed to do a presidential thing, I think it's more of a satire on how saturated presidential campaigns are nowadays. And it's a really like that whole point of this book is essentially to say, look how fucking stupid how this is, and then you sort of cross-reference it to what things are going on now. It's not that different. So I think that is kind of where everything sort of stems from, because like the first three issues, it's basically like showing the corrupt politicians and the corrupt companies and CEOs and everything, which aren't actually people. It's essentially just humanoids with like giant stickers on there, like not stickers, but like laser images, like holograms, that's the word, holograms on their face of like the logo and shit, and like that's how you know that that person is a company as opposed to a person. Huh. And like how companies are now people with our day and age and politics and everything, that's where I sort of like got the satirical context for it, and that's why I really like this book if you look at it from that perspective. At face value, if you think of it as just this really weird universe where you're allowed to tweet and a 19-year-old can become president, it's a horrible book. But if you sort of have that satirical mind that I have, also a little bit cynical, you'll understand. You'll see it from my perspective a little bit better, and you'll like it a lot. I actually really dug this book a lot.
Gotcha. Maybe I was completely. I feel like I heard nothing but bad things about it, so maybe I was completely wrong.
Yeah, and I guess there's a really big like there's a really big fandom, because Nick had mentioned something about how DC basically said that like we're gonna have at least a 12-issue run with everything, and like Prez, I guess, wasn't gonna make it for that. I guess Nick, you know more about this than I do, but you mentioned something to me about it.
Yeah, well, yeah. They talked about it in last week's episode with the whole Omega Men thing, right?
Right. Well, what's interesting, or at least a little bit different about Prez is that Prez was never meant to be an ongoing series.
I see.
It was meant to be 12 issues and done, and a lot of I think Prez fans felt that the fact that it was never meant to be an ongoing would at least ensure the title from being canceled. And now that DC has basically gone back on the fact that they said all DCU titles would reach the 12-issue threshold before cancellation, Prez fans are, of course, naturally quite concerned, especially because this book was not naturally written as an ongoing. It was written as 12 issues, which means, obviously, there's a definitive beginning, a middle, and end.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And whether or not this book is going to see it all the way to that point is, at this point, unknown. But based on the Omega Men scenario, DC could have a real incident on its hand if it decides to cancel Prez. By that point, I would say that the fact that we haven't heard anything about Prez at this point at least means that Prez is probably safe through maybe the 7 or 8 issue mark.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, we'll still see. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But I dug it a lot if you look at it from the way that I looked at it, which is kind of weird. And then I finally decided to read The Dying and the Dead #1, because #3 recently came out. I was like, oh, I've mm-hmm. got the first two issues. I might as well read it. And then I was going to read all three issues, and I picked up #1, like, oh, this is kind of heavy. And so I took my time with it because I wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the first 6 pages or whatever, like, is like the prelude to the whole story. I'd never been hooked so much from such a cinematic beginning in a comic book than that. Like, I felt like I was reading a graphic novelized movie, essentially. And I really dug that style. I dug the art by it, and I kind of regret not reading it sooner, because it's something I really like. But luckily, because of some issues with production and creativity, whatever, I don't know the whole detail, but like, there's only been 3 issues out in like 1.5 years or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. Yeah, I think they said at the end of issue 3, John Hickman wrote in the back in the letters page, he's like, you know, Will, we intended this book to ship on time, but we ate up all of our like planning time when we put out that extra monsters. I think it's like 60 issues for, or 60 pages for issue 1, which is insane. It's a monster book.
It's
like
a really
you said.
Big
I think
book.
It was like for $5, like it's a steal for a single issue.
Yeah, no, it was a really big book, and I actually liked the lengthy issue 1, because there's some books that like it's longer, and I'm just like, why? Like, I don't think that you really should have made this a longer story, but this one sort of felt organic and sort of needed that longer tale to sort of explain mm-hmm. everything and get you into the atmosphere, the style, and basically just the whole world of that, and I think that was really cool. So I've got issues 2 and 3 sitting on my reading list, probably on the tippy top of my reading list, because I liked it so much. So, but that's mm-hmm. basically it from what I've read. But I really dug those 2 books, and you know, so comics are good.
Cool. Yeah, no, comics are always good. You know, I think I ask that question every week, but it's pretty much the same answer, I think. For me, I read a bunch this week. I finally sat down and read like the last 2 or 3 weeks worth of single issues of physical books that I had. So I grabbed two copies of Sex Criminals #12, because there was the XXX variant by Kate Leth, which is very, very XXX. But that's #12.
Vin Diesel's involved?
No.
Ice Cube's involved?
No,
God. State of the Union's involved?
Oh, Nick, stop with that.
I actually got that reference. I like that.
Yeah, it's a good, I mean, Sex Criminals is consistently good when it comes out. There were issues with production that were simply based around the fact that Matt Fraction and Chip Zdarsky were trying to ship 1,000 custom sketched covers in poly bags, and it just didn't work out, which delayed production, and they're just like sitting on all these books, and it's a bunch of money misspent. If you can find a copy of #12 and just read the last couple pages with the letters column, where Matt Fraction goes on in all caps for 1.5 pages about how fucked up issue #12 was, or issue #11 and #12 were, to try to get them released. Otherwise, it was a good issue. I snagged a copy of Plutona #1. I know that came out a couple weeks back, but I heard some good things and some positive rumblings about it. So I decided to grab that, and it was good. I'm not 100% certain if I'll continue reading it, but it was a good #1. I could see big Jeff Lemire fans digging this book. I read Injection #5, which is a continuation of Warren Ellis's serialized graphic novel, as he said many, many times in his newsletter. This book is not a single-issue comic book. It is a serialized graphic novel, which I think is a very interesting distinction. And that continues to be weird and fairy tale-ish, and I say fairy tale-ish because the subject matter is dealing with these, just like the old folklore and like fairy tales of England, as well as like future technology and how you can inject something awful into the world. I won't spoil it, because number five is a pretty big reveal as to what's actually going on in the book. I read Fight Club number 4 and 5. This book continues to be impressive to me. I don't know what it is. I still really like it. I want to say that it's because I had a great love for Fight Club when I was in high school, but this book is actually pretty good, and Chuck Palahniuk has managed to transition his writing over to comic books pretty well, so I'm pretty impressed by that. I read The Spire number 3, which I think what I'm gonna do with this book is, I think it's a 6-issue miniseries. I'm gonna keep buying it and then read it all in a go, because I feel like I keep getting lost in this book. It's good. It's Simon Spurrier at doing what Simon Spurrier does well, but I can't ever keep the character straight in my head, which may be because I'm reading too many comic books, or may just be because things aren't clear enough, but I think it's probably the former. And let's see, I read The Material number 4, Alice Cott. I'll just leave it at that.
Agreed.
And, you know, he's just wild and out there.
If you're smart, you know, you really can't go into like a 1-minute blurb on that book.
Exactly. And the last thing I read was The Bunker Volume 1. I recently joined like a book club with some people that I work with. And that's a really weird book, mostly because the format of that book changed dramatically between issues 2 and 3. And from what I understand, it's because the book was originally a Comixology submit book. They published 1 or 2 issues, and apparently the first issue was supposed to be like this experimental motion-ish comic thing that they were going to try to do, where they publish a digital version and then like a digital animated version, and then that didn't work out, so they published issue 2, and then Oni Press picked it up, and they then issues number 3 and 4 were published as like 22-page issues, whereas the first two issues were like 33 pages or something like that. So the first volume feels really disjointed and weird, and it felt like going from issue 2 to issue 3, there was a crazy change in like trajectory on the book. So the first volume reads really weird. The story is pretty good, but I had some problems with the way that they developed some of the characters. I felt like there was way too many stereotypes going on in the book, and like they were trying to break from the stereotypes of people, and it just, I don't know, it didn't work out too well. So I don't know. I want to continue reading the book, but I still feel very weird about it. So yeah, a lot of books on my plate this week. I don't know if you guys had commentary. I just kept talking. So
I think I agree with you on Platona.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge Jeff Lemire fan, but I like his work enough to where I picked up Platona without question, and because I like the premise of it. And it was not what I expected. And people are like, oh, it's not what you're going to expect. It's not what you're going to expect, but that's a good thing. It's a good thing. I picked it up. It wasn't what I expected. I knew it wasn't what I was going to expect because I was told that, but I disagree with the latter part of it. I didn't think it was a great thing. I didn't think it was a good thing. It was different, but I didn't know how I felt about it.
So let's talk about our comic picks for this week. Jeff, what is your pick for this week?
It was kind of slim pickings for me because there's not a whole lot of Image books that I read that are coming out this week, and that's primarily what I read. But I did notice that Material Volume 1 is coming out. And I haven't... I love Aleska. I loved him. I love Zero. I read Wolf. I like his style of writing. I like his versatility. And I heard good things about Material. I just haven't picked it up and read it yet. So I think that picking up this trade and just reading it all in one go might be a good idea. But I guess it's kind of heavy from what you sort of alluded to when you mentioned that you read number 4. So
yeah,
I'm excited to see what sort of comes with it and see if I should read this, issue by issue in the trade, or if I should just read this all in one go. So I guess we'll have to figure that out. But that's the book that I am probably going to be getting this week, or it's my number 1 pick at the very least. So that's something that I'm looking forward to. But, you know, a lot has been said about Material before, but I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I think I know you pretty well. I mean, we know each other a while. Mm-hmm. I think this is, given your love of, like, news reporting and politics, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, comics and things like that, I think this book is totally right up your alley.
Okay.
I think you will love this book more than any other Alice Cott book you've read before, hands down.
That is a very tough order, but I will...
I'll
keep that in mind when I pick it up.
Okay, cool. And if you absolutely hate it, I expect you to come back to the show and tell me how much you didn't like it.
I will, with my pitchfork and torches.
Perfect. Nick, what's your pick for this week?
Well, my pick is They're Not Like Us, number 8. I actually had a hard time arriving at that because I originally thought that I was only going to have to deal with a Sandman Overture and They're Not Like Us, and so it was down to those two. But then, and I think you've experienced the same phenomena, you go, well, let's just leaf through everything that's coming out this week and make certain that I subscribed to all of the stuff that I'm getting.
Right.
And then I went through and it was like, oh, the Batman Annual. And I'm like, damn it. And then it's like, oh, don't forget the Fall of Harbinger one shot. And I'm like, damn it. And then it's like, oh, and here's the Disciples number 4. So now you're going to pay more than double what you thought your pull was this week. Mm-hmm. Yay. I'm not going to give it to Sandman Overture number 6, mainly because I'm not 100% certain I'm going to actually have that book in my hand.
Yes. Yes.
And if you don't know why that is, then you can go pretty much listen to any other podcast, except for the more recent ones where I think my references to Sandman Overture have been deservedly scrubbed, which is fine. I don't want no scrub. That is what they, as the mantra goes. Standing in the passenger side, trying to holler at me or something. I'm not certain. Anyway, so I arrived at They're Not Like Us number 8, which is really interesting for me at least, because this book was really on the fence. I was reaching a point about a week ago where I was like, something's got to give. That book was definitely up there. I thought 6 closed the first arc really well, but I thought the first arc really dragged in the middle, and I needed to see some real stuff actually happen for me to continue. And I really enjoyed 7. I realized 7, I went and looked up some other reviews because I really liked it. I guess a lot of other people thought it was sort of an issue where not a lot happened, and for me that was okay. But it was super interesting to see the group, or whatever you want to call them. I don't think they have a collective name. It was really interesting to see the group sort of struggle to find a new footing, and to try to place themselves inside mainstream society again, or at least to attempt such. Mm-hmm. And then the main character, who I think is that's Cid, right? Or
yeah.
I don't remember if that's her given name or her assigned name.
It's but, a name that we know her by, yeah.
Right, and we sort of see her struggling to keep the group safe and cohesive and efficient, and realizing that a lot of the decisions that might have to be made in order for that to happen sound quite a bit like what the voice was doing. And so she's sort of reaching an uncomfortable realization that she might be more like the voice than she thought. And I thought the ending of that issue was also very well done. So They're Not Like Us, number 8, is my pick of the week, mainly because it's keeping me reading. 7 did a good enough job to keep me reading the book in the first place.
Yeah, that book, I've been reading that book as well. And the one thing I could say about it that I appreciate every single month, and I always forget about it. I'm sure I won't now, but I always forget that the front cover is the first panel of the book. Like, that is such a cool concept to me. Like, there's no ads, there's no promotions, there's no nothing in it. It's just the comic book, including the cover, is as part of the comic. It's not just some picture that has no reference to the book. It literally is the first panel. I love that.
Yeah.
I think that's great every month.
And I definitely think that probably has to be a decision made by Fonographics, who's in charge of the graphic design and whatnot. Mm-hmm. For the book. And I could be wrong. I do believe he was the designer for, why am I blanking on his name? Ethan Stevenson, is it?
Eric Stevenson?
Eric Stevenson. I believe he was also the designer of Stevenson's other really well-known book, Nowhere Men.
Yeah.
And it shows. The real eye for design elements is spot on in this book.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, my pick for this week is, no surprise, I think I've picked it every month, is Archie number 3.
Okay.
This book is so much fun. I can't get enough of it. It is, as I've said time and time again, it is a breath of fresh air. It's a happy-go-lucky book that's got slapsticky humor that just is has no shame about what it is. It knows that it is a goofy little world inside of, you know, that exists outside of all other comic books, where everything's happy-go-lucky and fun, and it's a truly all-ages comic book where there's a little bit of romance, there's like fun, there's stupid practical jokes, there's dumb humor. Like the humor or the big joke in issue two was that Archie was trying to work on this construction site and he kept finding himself like getting hurt and all of his friends had to save him from himself, essentially, which is a throwback to, I guess, the original Archie, which I never really read much of. But nonetheless, it was just fun. It's just a book that like I'm smiling the entire time that I'm reading because there's nothing horrible. There's no dark twist to look forward to. There's just, oh, what's going to happen next? And you just, I don't know. I just have absolute enjoyment in this book. Like, I'm really excited. And the unfortunate thing about this issue is that it's Fiona Staples' last issue. So where they're going with art next month, I don't know. But I know that Mark Waid is going to continue writing it. So I have absolute faith in this book. Plus, I'm really excited for Jughead number one for some reason. I'm hooked on this Archie train.
Are you certain, Mike, that number two wasn't Staples' last issue? I seem to think that she was getting the cutoff at two.
I believe it's number three. I could be wrong, but I feel like when they announced it, they said she's only doing three issues. Then they're moving on to someone else. Who that next person is, we have no idea. But I'm sure that I feel like the Archie company has taken a lot of, or they're making a lot of very educated like things. They're trying to make the best book they possibly can. So I'm sure that they won't be picking someone who's just like another standard Archie, you know, artist, like the, you know, like the house style and all that stuff. So I'm really totally excited about this book. It's going to be really good. Are you guys reading Archie at all?
I didn't know Archie was still out. Didn't know it was still a thing.
At every supermarket.
Yeah.
As you're waiting in line.
I thought it was just in the Sunday funnies.
There at all.
Yeah, no. I know, it's good, Jeff. It's fun.
Yeah, I pick it up. It's not on my pull, but if it's there, I usually pick it up, especially if there's a cover I like, which, my gosh, this book just keeps rolling out 5, 6, 7 covers every time. So
yeah.
It's not only like, do I want Archie? It's like, yeah, you want Archie, but what cover do you want? And it's like, too many choices.
Which covers do you want is the question.
Oh, no.
Multiple covers.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about you know, more comic stuff. So we'll be back in just a second. So sometime late last week, Justin Jordan, creator of series such as Legacy of Luther Strode, Spread, writer of Shadow Man, creator of Dead Body Road, published a blog post talking about the price point over at Image Comics and how their volume ones are usually $9.99 and subsequent volumes are $14.99. His basic idea is that he thinks that price point doesn't necessarily work. Not that all books at Image Comics should be more than $9.99, but that some books don't necessarily warrant the $9.99 mark because their numbers are smaller. And so the basic idea of Image's price point being $9.99 for all volume ones is that the barrier of entry is lower, therefore more people will buy them, therefore we will make more money or something along those lines. And if people get hooked, then they'll buy the higher price point books later. He was arguing that sometimes it just doesn't work. And so throughout the article, he talked about how for books that he worked on, since those are the books he can really only speak for, having the $9.99 price point does work, but in other cases it doesn't. So I shared this article, and I'll put this in the show notes for this week for you to read over. It's a very, very well-written, or I guess well-constructed article, basically voicing his thoughts. I just wanted to see what Jeff, you and Nick thought about this. I know that Nick, I think the moment I found it last week, you happened to send me the same link. So we must have found it at roughly the same time, I guess. But yeah, did you guys have any thoughts on this? I mean, do you think that the $9.99 price point works for all books at Image?
Well, that kind of sets me up for failure. But I mean, the short answer to that is no.
Yeah.
The short answer is no. I don't think that the $9.99 price point works for all books, but I will say it works for about 90% of the books. I think that Justin Jordan is talking about a very niche market. Like he talks about his book Spread and Strode, for that matter, as he says. You know, he says that like he feels that the $14.99 price point was better point for them. but doesn't really explain why that's the case. I mean, he explains like why some points are price points are better for other people, but like he doesn't justify specifically for his book. So it's sort of, I feel like the foundation is kind of crumbling. Like, I don't understand how he determined that comparing his single issue sales with his trade sales. And what I would like to know is the difference between his single issue sales and trade sales compared to other books of notoriety, like, for instance, Saga Volume 1 in their single issue sales or something like that. Like, I would love to be able to see some sort of comparison to it, because he titled it Making Sausage, and the whole, the whole saying is, like, you know, once you know how sausage is made, you don't want to buy it anymore. But, like, he doesn't really go in depth as opposed to just basically saying, like, I think that some books shouldn't be $9.99. I think some books should be $14.99 because people are going to buy it no matter what anyway. And that's sort of the whole reason why people in other industries aren't spending as much money, is because they sort of assume that, like, no matter what price point they'll do, people will buy it. So I think that he's got some fair points, but, like, primarily I think that he needs to have a stronger argument to sort of get my, I guess, vote or agreement in this, because I think that the $9.99 price point is great for most people that are like, oh, I'd like to sort of pick this up and see how it goes, because that's how I picked up Sex Criminals, that's how I picked up Deadly Class. I didn't know anything about Rick Remender, but now that I have Deadly Class, I want to pick up Black Science, I want to pick up his other books and everything, because I picked up a $9.99 trade. I wouldn't have picked it up if it was $15. I would have picked it up if it was $10. That's it, because that's sort of where I expect Image to do with their Volume 1 trades now, which as a consumer is kind of a shitty thing to assume, but at the same time, it's one of the main reasons why I'll buy an Image trade over any other trade when it comes to Volume 1. If I have to choose between Volume 1 of an Image series that I'm interested in or a Marvel series that I'm a little bit more interested in, I'll probably still buy the Image one because of the price point.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I don't really agree with a lot of Justin Jordan's logic here. I do think that price point matters. I think sometimes, and I realize that this doesn't seem like your average comic book consumer. I think a lot of times comic book consumers are seen as hyper knowledgeable. They know exactly what they want. They know exactly where to get it. They're not interested in anything else. And the idea that they're maybe browsing or looking around really isn't a thing. But for me, frequently, I'll just look around and I'll see what's there. Maybe I just want something to read. And the sheer fact that a book has been greenlit by Image, I mean, the Image selection process these days, and I've seen some of it, and I'm sure, Mike, you're familiar with some of it as well, it's really intense. Like, it is a very intense vetting process. So the sheer fact that an Image book has actually been produced generally means that the level of quality is already more or less assured there. And so for me, if I'm just casually looking for something to read, yeah, if there's an Image book and it sounds interesting, and especially if the price is like $10, yeah, I'm probably going to go pick that up. Because for me, I'm pretty certain the quality is already there. And if there's a writer or someone on a team that I'm already pretty confident with, then I don't really feel like I'm making a huge risk to buy that book. Now, I do sort of feel where Justin Jordan is getting or going with this when he says, now, if you're the writer, then you can work on other books, and so you're a little bit more versatile. Mm-hmm. But say, for example, say that you're an artist on an Image book, and he says, unless you're on a really, really, really successful Image book, you would be better off financially working on a Big Two title, which sounds like a no-brainer, right? I mean, of course.
Well, there's also that idea that he implies that, like, if you're on working on one book, that's probably the one book you're working on. I mean, it's pretty rare for us to find comic book artists that are working on multiple books at once. Especially if you're the penciler or inker. I mean, there are these wunderkind like Jordi Belair, who is a colorist primarily, and she will work on a billion books. Like, I think she was on like 15 books like last year. And
that's insanity.
And she talks, I mean, if you follow her on Twitter or anything like that, she'll say, you know, she kills herself to do it, but it's because she wants to do that as a full-time job. Like, if you want to get into comics as an artist, like, that becomes your full-time job because you want to deliver quality and you want to deliver your content on time. And so as an artist, let me stumble over some more words. As an artist, such as a penciler or an inker, when you're on a book, like, that's the book that you're on, period. I'm sure inkers probably can work on multiple books, but I think pencilers in specific, it's one book or maybe two if you're lucky.
Yeah, and you're more or less, it is really one artist works, one penciler can only work on one book. It really is 99% of the time true. And so he says that for those people, if you're working on an image book, you're probably making less money than if you're at DC, which, fine, let's go along with the assumption. And that in order to make a living wage, you really have to make back a lot of that money on trades. And he feels that the $9.99 price point really doesn't help there. He says that it takes longer for your book to get into the black that way, which means it takes even longer for you to get your profits because I forget what he talks about, but something along the lines of you only get paid every couple months for trades. So yeah, it can take even longer. So yeah, I sort of feel where he's getting at that point, but that argument is still based on the idea that that his idea that this $9.99 price point does not work. It does not encourage enough extra sales to make up for having a higher price point. And sure, I agree that there are books like Wicked and Divine that are probably far outpacing, for example, his book Spread, but by no means, like, I would have to see the figures, but I don't think that means, like, Spread is doing bad by any, you know,
yeah, he goes on to say that Spread is doing well. He said it's doing better than he expected, I think.
Yeah. And like I said, personally for me, his idea just doesn't resonate with me because I'm the complete opposite of this model that he's suggesting in the first place. I do buy $9.99 trades on impulse, and I don't always do a lot of research, or I'm not someone who's already studied it enough to a certain point that I'll buy it at whatever price. You know, I'm already locked in at 15 anyway. That's not true.
Yeah, I think that there's a the side of things that we're not necessarily looking at is that setting the bar at $9.99 is great, and it does lower that barrier to entry.
Mm-hmm.
But like, whether, you know, a lot of people don't realize, I guess what I'm trying to say here is most, I guess if you're looking at new comic book readers, people who aren't like obsessed with this as much as we are, they sure don't necessarily know the difference between Image, Dark Horse, Marvel, DC, whoever they are. To most people, I think, and I know I'm making a large generalization here, but I think the non in the world of comic books type of people are, they see comic books at a level medium. They don't know the difference. They don't know that Spider-Man doesn't fight with Superman, or that, you know, that Hellboy, you know, it doesn't hang out with Invincible, or who Invincible is in the first place. So they come and they see these comics, they go, oh, this looks interesting. They look at the back cover. They don't know that $9.99 is the norm. They just know it's $9.99. So if you know, they see it's $14.99 versus $9.99, they'll go, what's the difference? You know, why is one priced differently? And I don't know. I think, like, if you set the bar at $14.99, that's no different than if you set the bar at $9.99 in that case. There's a lot. I think we assume a little bit of research here, and I think that's a bad assumption is what I'm getting at.
I kind of disagree. One of the very first things I learned about comics in general is that there's the big two, and you can get trades for them for around $15, $16. And that's their norm.
Not Marvel.
Well, true.
Well, nonetheless.
Anyway, there's this price point for the big two, and then there's this price point for Image, and it's always $9.99 for volume one. That's always the case. And I'm like, oh, and as, like, since that was one of the first things I learned, that's why I gravitate. That's one of the many reasons I gravitated towards Image, because I was like, oh, I can try out these books for $10 and get way more bang for my buck than I could for some of the trades that are out right now on the big two or any other publisher or anything like that. I'm down to sort of do that. So, I mean, that was a very big reason why I decided to sort of put all of my eggs in one basket, if you will, because Image offers this price point that nobody else really can match, especially the big two.
Yeah. Yeah, but again, back to my point, I think that's doing a little bit of research. That's looking into things. If you're someone that walks into a comic shop and you go, "Oh, what are these things? These collected editions? Like, why is the price difference?" Like, you don't necessarily know. And to the article's point, I think his whole thing is he wants to make sure that the people that he's working with that are getting paid, you know, especially the artists, the people that are putting in so much work and so much time and dedication to make these books happen. If they're not getting paid, then what's to say that they're going to stick with the book or that they'll want to even continue it or do another book like this in the future, unless it sells really phenomenally well. You know, like if you're getting numbers like in Walking Dead, like I don't think that there's a problem about, you know, publishing or working on one book and publishing them at $9.99 for the first volume. But, you know, if you're working on a new book for the first time and you're just trying to make it in the industry and you're not seeing that return simply because there's this across the line bar that says your books have to sell at $9.99 for volume one. And again, I don't know how all the internals work, but if that bar is set there and you kind of look at, you know, Justin Jordan, he points out, he says, "I don't know how if other people are doing these calculations or how they're doing these calculations, but this is what I've figured out." He says he's kind of implying that it doesn't work out well for a lot of people unless your book is a sudden hit and people are talking about it. It becomes critically acclaimed and sells 45,000 copies on the first issue, you know? So there's just a worry about the health of this industry by setting this price point so low. I don't know. I just we have to worry about the creators at some point. Like, yeah, we are paying for it out of pocket, but the problem is in the industry. And if we are people that are trying to see how we can help the industry, this is something we have to consider, I think.
Yeah, sure. I think... I tip my hat to Justin Jordan because he totally gets that being a writer, he is totally capable of having his fingers in so many different pies at once because that's just the nature of being a writer, right? I mean, that's just really how it works. And so he is blessed with the ability to go to Image and do the book he wants and tell the story he wants to tell. And really, when you're a writer, there are not many better places to be than Image if you've got independent and creative ideas. But he's completely right. If you're the artist, you don't have your fingers in multiple pies. You're working on this one book, more than likely. And depending upon how the single issues sell and depending upon how the trades sell, that's your future. And part of me says, well, most Image books, probably all Image books, trade number two is $15. And so as long as you're able to string these people along, as long as your book is able to continue past the first trade, and as long as your artist, and maybe this is what he's getting at and what you're getting at, Mike, as long as your artist is willing to quote-unquote stick it out, maybe when trade two rolls along, you're in a much better situation. The question is, what happens in that area in between trade one and trade two when you're maybe feeling these repercussions of working with a $9.99 trade? And how does that affect the artist who can't walk off and do some other project? Maybe he can do some cover art or something like that, but by and large, we pretty much are all aware that you really can't do full-time penciling work on multiple books. It's just not possible.
Yeah, so this is definitely something that is interesting. I've never heard this before. I know that I've heard Jim Zub, who, you know, he's a creator of Skull Kickers. Wayward is his latest book, I believe. He's like probably one of the more vocal people in comics. If you follow him on Twitter, he's very much the type of person that wants to remove the veil of the mysteries of the comic book industry. And I've heard him talk about single issue sales and about how why prices have gotten, you know, have moved from $2 to $2.50 to $3. And in Marvel and DC's case, you know, in some cases like $4 or $5 for books. And partially the latter with Marvel and DC, some of that is kind of just like greed to an extent, but nonetheless, book prices increasing is strictly due to a lot of just increasing costs, and how much money actually comes back to the creators is somewhere around like 5% and 10% of a comic book sale. It's unbelievable.
Is
so
it really that
you know,
low?
It's insanely low. I implore you to look for a blog post that he wrote all about this. I'll actually find it and I'll put it in the show notes, but I'll send it to you as well, Jeff.
Yeah.
He breaks it down for his own personal book, saying, you know, we sell a book at $2.99. Here is how my guesstimates. There's some fuzzy work because obviously he's not sitting in the image or whatever publishing company. He's not sitting in their financial office, you know, figuring out the actual dollars and cents. But his based on his estimates and how much he's been able to research himself, he breaks it down in the most clear, most forward way possible.
Yeah.
And creators, you know, so which is why when a book sells 6,000 copies, you're like, yeah, that's 6,000. But, you know, what's 5% of 299 times 6,000? It's not a lot, you know. So
I didn't come on this podcast to do math.
I know. So like I said, you should read this blog post where he breaks it down. But when a book sells 45,000 copies or like 200,000 copies, you know, in the case of like Secret Wars, there's a lot of profit to be reaped. And so, and this is why you see books when they get under about 10,000 or even 8,000, you see them disappear because that's just not profitable. It doesn't become profitable for anybody, the creators or the publisher. So it's, you know, the money part of comic books is very interesting because there's a lot of hands that get that have a hold of each of these issues that are sold.
Right. The answer to your question, by the way, Mike, is about $900.
$900, oh. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then split that by two or three, yep, or five, depending on how many people are on that book. So
12, if you have enough inkers.
Yeah, with enough inkers, there could be 12 people on a book. So,
but I mean, here's my question for you, Mike. If you look at his argument, and you look at maybe the problematic situation that it puts a penciler in, and maybe the temptation for them to jump off the book, his scenario seems most valid when either A, you see a penciler leave a title, or B, you see an image book that does not make it to a second arc or a third arc. And I'm not trying to get like aggressive or on point about this. I'm just kind of curious. When was the last time you can actively think of maybe an image book of yours that didn't reach that point? Or can you offhand think of image books that really have bottomed out after an arc or two recently? Because I feel like Image has really insulated itself from failure within the last year or two, because it seems like most of the writers are, and we've talked about this before, it feels like Image is successful people, that this is their personal project on the side of doing DC stuff, and maybe you see some new artists, but a lot of the time it is other successful artists that have already established themselves that are now doing their personal like pet project. I realize that's about nine questions, but
no. To answer your first question, I think the book that has had two books I can think of that this has happened to recently, God Hates Astronauts, which is a book that I was reading in trade, ended after the second trade or maybe the third trade, I think. And I believe it was due to numbers, like it just wasn't selling well enough.
Sure.
There's two trades. Technically, there's three, but the first trade was a reprint of blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. Sure. That book ended, I think, at issue 9 or maybe 10. And another book that I was reading every week in single issues was Cowl. Cowl just recently ended at 11, and I believe that was strictly due to numbers, you know?
Right.
So, and as from my understanding, Kyle Higgins and Rod Reese, who I believe were on that book, I don't think they were doing much else. I think Reese might have been doing covers, but...
Well, Reese is actually a full-time colorist for DC. That's his main job.
Yeah.
And Higgins, so of side course, project, was... Yeah. You know, he was doing a lot of Batman stuff for DC and
So I mean, I think those are prime examples. God Hates Astronauts by Ryan Brown. I mean that was a book that he did by himself. He wrote it, he drew it, he colored it, inked it, he did everything. Like, the book was really solid. If you're into comedy books like that, sure. And that book was very outlandish and ridiculous, but it was fun. And I think that it just didn't sell well. Just, you know, and so now it's over. And that he's moving on and he's doing another project, but. I think that's one prime example of someone who wasn't doing anything for other big publishers. I think he might have done like a cover or two for Marvel, like a variant cover or something. But other than that, I don't think he was doing much else, and the book just didn't do well. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a money game at that point, you know? Like, is this book profitable? No, it's not, so we have to end it.
Right. Exactly. By no means second. I want your girlfriend in a car. I want your girlfriend in love. I want your place at the bar. Because there's always another man to chop off your head. And watch it roll into the basket. And then you should drop in the night. Then they won't have to ask you twice. Recently, for those not aware, one of the 18 billion, roughly 18 billion Comic-Cons that exists, took place, and that was Baltimore's. And during the course of that, we learned that Boom is putting out a new initiative. They're actually going to decrease their product by 15%, which offhand you go, well, there's a decrease in product, and that must mean that there's some sort of systemic failure going on. What's going on with Boom? That actually sounds quite awful. I thought they were doing fine with their regular show comics that have 18 different covers. And apparently it's not a bad thing at all. Boom apparently feels that the current comic book industry is much too concerned with not getting new readers, but rather creating a whole large batch of titles that they can sell to the exact same reader set. Which is an interesting argument to be had there.
Shots fired, man. Shots fired. That's
oh, yeah. I mean, it really, I mean, they're basically saying, well, we know that there's 19 million Batman books, which is true, and
yeah.
God bless them for putting out all of them. What else am I going to read? And again, that's only a half joke. And basically, how do you feel if you're a DC reader and DC continues to make metric buttloads of money? That's a European measurement. You have to convert that into U.S. fluid ounces. And I feel like there's not a place for me at DC, which, of course, that's why the DCU was recently launched. So stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Boom Comics, until DC cancels all of them in the next 6 months.
Yeah, because New 52 is a great series, great run, too.
Oh, man. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Thank you for your sincerity about my favorite thing ever. So, again, only half joking. Anyway, now that my lifeblood's been threatened... Boom is also introducing, alongside of that, an incentive program for retailers, which has been very creatively, and I'm sure they pored over this for hours, called the Boom Innovator Program. And I think this is quite interesting because it seems kind of demanding for retailers, so I'm really interested to hear what you guys think, but let me read this first. They're going to ask shops to stock all of the new Boom single issues, and they need to stock these titles, issues 1 through 4, every single quarter of the year. Now, the quantity that your store will have to stock will be based on, and I think this is kind of weird, but whatever, it's based on the number of locations within your store's franchise.
Okay.
Now, if you sell all of those single issues, you have to do 1 through 4, you have to meet their quota, Boom will allow retailers to return all unsold copies up to 4 times a year and redeem those books for free shipments of replacement Boom stock.
Okay.
What do you guys think about this? Does this sound like a good deal? Does this sound like Boom is maybe asking too much?
So when you say free shipments of replacement Boom stock, does that mean other books that aren't necessarily those 1 through 4?
That's my understanding. Because okay. It would be, I mean, I'm not 100% either, but it would be pretty bad if you're like, well, you know what? Here's regular show 23. It doesn't sell worth shit. And they're like, here's a new regular show 23. I hope you have better luck with this one.
I can see the advantage if the idea is to say, we want to make sure that you have number ones in stock for people when they come into your shop. I think that's great. You know, right. under the idea that when people walk into the shop, a lot of times it's like, oh, you know, this is the constant fight in comics. Oh, there's 800 comics in DC or in Detective Comics. I don't want to read that book. I don't want to pick it up at number 800. Where's number one? You know, that is a thing where, you know, it's where people feel discouraged about jumping into new comics, despite it saying great jumping on point. You know, we run into that problem that Jeff, I think, was talking about in the pre-show about how he couldn't get into new books, even new number ones when the DC New 52 came out, because even the number ones had like this implied knowledge or something like that. But that's not what I'm trying to get at. That's not what I'm trying to get at here. I think the idea is that maybe they're trying to encourage retailers to keep these number ones in stock so that when people come in and they say, where do I start? They have that number one in stock. They can say, just pick up this book right here, $2.99 or $3.99, because it's Boom. Read this book and that's the beginning of the story. You don't need to know anything else. It's all year round. Even if number 10 of that series is out, they still have the number ones. Or maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but I think that's based on the notes that we have here. I think that's what it sounds like to me. It's just they're trying to lower the barrier of entry, not to trades, but instead to single issues, which is a much smaller, you know, investment for people.
Yeah, and I think what I find really, really odd, or I guess sort of interesting about this is that I guess for me, it seems rather odd that Boom goes, well, Boom's justification is this. This is what they said. They would really like to be able to tell potential Boom customers, if you're looking for this comic, here's a list of places that have guaranteed to us that you can go to these places and you will get that book that you're looking for, which gotcha. Is rather odd that you have someone going to the Boom website and then instead of going, here's your digital comic, Boom goes, here's a place that you can go, even though you're already at this website, and you can get the comic. I'm not saying that I disapprove of the idea. It's just kind of bizarre in a way. But this is an interesting twist I have on it that I just sort of occurred to me. So they're saying you need to stock 1 through 4, right? Mm-hmm. And 1 through 4 is sort of, especially with like Boom and especially with IDW, where their trades are not big. 1 through 4 is basically trade number 1, more or less, correct?
I would imagine so.
I believe so. They're, I mean, I think that varies from comic to comic, but I think, yeah.
I think IDW and Boom, they tend to be smaller, but it's sort of like they're trying to circumvent people that are trade waiting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, well, why wait for the trade? Here are all the single issues. And of course, I think one could argue that there's more money to be made off of selling those 4 issues individually than the trade. So in a way, it seems like maybe they're trying to address, and this goes back to the whole Justin Jordan thing, address the fact that smaller publishers like Image and like Boom are having a lot of success in the trade market. And they're trying to actually reverse that and maybe do better in single issues. Does that sound wrong, or am I totally branching this into, you know, me out in the lodge with the strings and the push pins and forgetting the babies in the bathtub at the house?
It sounds plausible.
And Ed Harris is going
to
drop my mail off real soon.
It sounds very plausible to me. The first thing that sort of comes to my mind is partially that, now that you said it. But also, and this might just be me being kind of crazy, is that like Boom is...
Don't be crazy. Go for
it. I think Boom is sort of celebrating the community that your local comic book shop could bring you as opposed to other things. And if they're
totally.
Like, if they're
totally.
Like, hey, we've got issues 1 through 4 at these places, go to your local comic shop and support them and do it that way. And I think that would be... much more beneficial for them in the long run, because once you know the like heroin dealers, the first one's always free, but
oh boy,
you know what?
Oh, Boom no. Comics, oh, no. That comparison was made with love, okay?
Yeah, Jeff Perry is not a regular guest on the show.
But Jeff
Perry
did not totally... just compare being Puppy Cat to Black Tar.
Yeah, actually, that was the first thing that came to my mind. I think after you know, looking over this for a little bit, I think when you go to a comic book shop, I mean, unless you're real strict about your budget and you're like, I'm only going to this shop to buy this one comic, look at the floor
unless
until you find
decent
it.
Willpower.
Yeah, and there's, again, this getting away from the whole, well, we live in a consumer-based blah, 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 blah. You're going to a comic book shop. There's going to be all sorts of things that you like if you're into any sort of nerd culture, if you have any interest in what I guess I'm considering nerd culture. You know, Doctor Who, Lord of the Rings, you know, board games, video games, and like paraphernalia that goes along with all of these various pieces of, you know, nerd culture, I guess. If you walk in there and you're just there to buy that one comic book, good. I mean, that's great. You spent your $4 on that comic book and you left. But if you walk into a shop and you see this one comic book for $3.99, and then you go, oh, look, there's all these other number ones. Or there's, oh, look, here's a Walking Dead figurine that I had my eye on, and it's here. I could get it right now. It's all, you know, it's impulse buys. And to go to the, like, when you're on a website, there is no impulse buy. Like, yeah, you could weigh over buying more digital comics or buying, you know, more comics and having them delivered to your house or something. But when you're in the shop, you're in that moment and you're talking to a comic book shop person, or you see other people buying things, or you see other things that you may not be able to find online easily, and it's just there and you can pick it up. Like, that's amazing. I mean, that's the whole thing about going to a comic book shop. It's not just, you know, finding your comics and buying them, but it's also potentially socializing, potentially finding other things that you wouldn't normally buy. It's a great opportunity, and I think if that's Bloom's goal, I have to support this, because going to your comic shop and buying stuff is the biggest thing you can do in comic books right now. You know, that's that you're supposed to buy, you know, vote with your dollar, and this is the best way to do it. And again, that's a whole different topic, but if that's their goal here, to try to get people to go to their comic book shop more often, and it's like free publicity on their website if they have this, here's our all of the retailers that carry this book, and it's also beneficial to the retailers outside of just publicity. You know, they're getting more people in their shop, more foot traffic, more potential, you know, buyers of things. I think that's amazing.
Mike, you actually made a really, really good point. I'm not, that makes it sound like you don't make them. You do, but this was a good one. Yeah. About impulse buys, and it's true. When I think about it, like, the majority of my impulse buys at comic book shops are what? They tend to be big two books, and yeah, it's because they can afford to overstock the big two a whole fucking bunch. So that's where your impulse buys tend to fall, just mathematically based on the sheer amount of extra comics that are there. They tend to be big too. So, and if you look at someone like Boom, most of your shops are not going to have extra issues of Boom, just because there's a real inherent risk there that without really firm pre-established characters, having extra copies of books like Bee and Puppy Cat, even though I get that it's a quote-unquote a thing, or Bravest Warriors or whatever, that's an inherent risk for comic book shops. Mm-hmm. So if you're simply providing people an alternative impulse buy, then maybe this is a great, you know, a great thing. And maybe the other issue is that, for example, maybe you wanted to try Bravest Warriors, but maybe they've only got number 3. Well, that's a dead end, and it's a dead end that seems to be seemingly alleviated by this program.
Yeah, and rather than the comic book shop people saying, you know, just trade weight it, instead they have 1 through 4. I mean, it's full circle here. We're coming back to the beginning of this, which is that they're going to have 1 through 4 in stock all the time. It's just lowering that barrier to entry.
Yeah, now the only uncomfortable truth is when you've got 1 through 4 in stock and then maybe sitting right next to it on the shelf, you've got the trade.
Well, yeah.
But they could also...
maybe you avoid that stocking scenario.
I mean, we said it before, they could just be doing this to sort of circumvent the trades altogether, so they might actually limit the amount of trades that they make, because all these comic shops have 1 through 4 anyway. What's the point of making the volume 1 trade? Or whatever, right. You know? Like, that could be another way of lowering their costs and making things more profitable, because they're putting their eggs more into the single issues as opposed to the trades. And if you're able to lower the barriers, why not, you know? So I think that you'll actually be... well, if this does go the way that we say that it seems to be going, where they've got 1 through 4, they might not even have that many trades. They might have 1 or 2 or whatever, depending on how big the shop is and whatever. But
yeah,
I think that they'll limit the amount of trades that they make, especially for volume 1.
The other side of this that I guess I didn't realize till now is just visibility. You know, like, if you see that there are 30, I mean, this is a high number, but there's like 30 Boom books sitting all on the shelves next to, you know, a dozen Image books or something like that, because they're all in stock and they've got a bunch of copies of it. You'll start to recognize those books more and more, and eventually maybe they'll pique your interest. You'll go, wow, you've got a lot of these in stock. What's so cool about them? And then you check them out. So that could be the other side of it, just visibility in general.
Yeah.
Sometimes it really is all about presence. I was talking to one of my local comic book shop owners, and he was telling me how Valiant Comics, they'll offer to come out like for free, and they'll do a demo for your store, and they'll mm-hmm. tell you about all of the books, and they'll set up a free display for you to put your Valiant books in, and
oh wow,
and all of this other stuff. I think you're right. Sometimes it is just about sheer visibility and saying, holy cow, Boom has like 15 or 20 books. I can't believe that. And believe it or not, they actually have a couple pre-existing franchises that I do enjoy, and maybe I need to give this a try. So, we'll see.
So yeah, this seems like, I mean, it feels like we're going to see a lot of Boom books in the future. I think that's awesome, creator owned or not. I mean, that's more indie comics out there. So this sounds like if a lot of retailers sign up, this could be a great thing for them and a great thing for writers and creators, I guess all of the creators that work for Boom. Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg. This episode was produced by Mike Rappin and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Supertramp, Son of Dork, Elvis Costello, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep current with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. Like music? So do we. In fact, the music in this episode was selected from this month's DTC Listens playlist. Check out our music section at destroythecybe.org/music for reviews as well as our monthly collaborative playlist. The world of comics is vast and varied, and sometimes we miss something. If you have a topic you want us to talk about on the podcast, or if you just want to say hi, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecybe.org. Also, feel free to hit us up on Twitter @destroythecybe and follow us on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
Anyways, okay. Do you guys want to talk about Batman Day? Do you want to do something that's about that or nerd holidays?
Sure, I don't care.
I need a decisive yes or no.
We can. It's not going to be a big topic though.
Yeah, it's going to be a small one.
You're going to be going around in circles after about 5 to 6 minutes, I think.
All right, then let's move on. Let's do something else. What else? Nick, your Boom's going to decrease their product by 15%.
It's interesting. Boom is actually saying that they feel like the big problem with the big two right now is that they're not trying to attract new readers. They're simply trying to sell more books to the same readers.
Welcome to why I never read big two.
And
I fight.
Staunchly fight. Disagree with that, but okay.
I absolutely agree with what Boom is saying.
How much Big Two does Jeff Perry read to make this educated opinion about
Jeff? Yeah, I don't think
Jeff read one Marvel book and decided that it was all shit. The end.
Yeah. Fuck that! No way, dude.
No. I know you've got a whole thing where you tried to read it.
With the new DC universe when DC New 52 came out, and I'm like, what the fuck is this shit? I still don't get it. And it's supposed to be a new universe. How fucking inconvenient is this for me? I'm gonna go to this other book. Oh, it's Invincible. Oh, there's a whole fucking comic book collection by Image that I can read. Oh, that sounds great to me. Fuck the big two. And that's essentially my whole story with comics.
Wow, that's like horribly like
impartial,
misinformed. Yeah.
The word you're looking for is impartial.
All right, guys, take your judgment hats off for a second. Let the man speak.
No, I'm leaving my judgment pants on, though.
That's essentially what happened, though. Like, I tried picking up shit, and I'm, like, the only thing I could understand was Batman, but, like, everything else, I'm just like, these are references to things I don't get. I want to be able to know what the fuck is happening. This is supposed to be a number one. Why is this so confusing? Why is this so hard for me to sort of have to, like, I have to go through, like, 4 fucking articles of Wikipedia and just trying to fucking understand what happened from A to B.
Just for my own, like, thinking about this, which comics did you pick up, New 52?
I picked, like, my first batch was Batman, and it was, what else was it?
So I know Court of Owls.
Yeah, it was Court of Owls, which I loved because that was a fresh take, and that sort of set the bar for me with anything DC New 52 related, which is probably
I'm
unfair.
The rest of them right back.
Which okay. is probably unfair for most of DC's stuff, but like I think I tried reading Aquaman, but I can't remember how that ended up. I didn't finish it. I never kept reading it, and then I tried reading Animal Man and Swamp Thing, and I didn't. I liked where that story was going, but I still wasn't understanding. It was the, it was issue like 1 through 6 of the, like the first run of the New 52 series of it.
Of what, Animal Man? Or you listed like 3 and then you said.
I was reading Swamp Thing and Animal Man concurrently. I was reading them both, I guess tandemly. I was reading about the same time as like what I've been told.
Simultaneously?
Yeah, that's the word. Anyway, so I was trying to read that, and then I was just like, "Oh, this story is like, I from the very beginning I was told to read them simultaneously, because by that point they already started the crossover, and I was like, oh, this is really fucking cool, I really like this story. But they kept referencing previous things about Swamp Man, and then like how he came to be at that point.
It's not his name.
Swamp Man and Animal Thing, yeah.
Whatever, we fucking get it. I'm trying to remember.
I know which issues you're talking about, and the whole like idea of it was, hey, this is a DC book, why is this guy not like a normal superhero? Oh, it's because of this thing called, yeah, like, and then they introduced the red and the green, and you're, yeah, like, okay, these are what these things are. And that's, so I mean, yeah, it was sort of referencing it, but it was also saying, this is what the story's about, it's not about these superheroes.
I don't know, it was really, like, I know for a fact that I'm wrong. I know I'm wrong, but
okay. But this argument continues, yeah, past that point?
Yes, it does.
Well, he's arguing for us now. I'm an American.
Like, I know for a fact that I'm wrong, but there's really been no incentive for me to want to go back, because as we've mentioned many times in the past, we and everybody else in the podcast has sort of mentioned, is that like every single time a new universe comes or some sort of quote-unquote change happens, nothing changes. And so for me, as an outsider looking in, I'm just like, well, if nothing's changing and we're all still on the same timeline treadmill of just fucking repetitiveness, like, what's the point of me jumping in? Because it's just going to happen again, or I'm not going to be able to know exactly what's going on. And so I was just really put off by that. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll just pick up these number ones, the Image, and a bunch of other indie or like smaller comics that aren't in the big two, to where I can like start from issue one and not have to know this giant 35-year history of all these characters and everything else. I don't have to know everything about that. And it's just a much easier way for me to sort of get started. And like, as a new reader, that's what I want. And even now, as a casual reader, that, you know, a regular casual reader, I guess you could call me, I still don't really have any idea or incentive as to why I should go and pick up the, DCU or whatever the new Marvel series is going to be called, or even Marvel Now. When that came out, I tried reading that and that didn't work. Like, I picked
how
up.
How far did you get into Batman? Did you read all the way through Court of Owls?
I read Court of Owls. I read City of Owls. I read The Joker. I forget what that, I think Death of the Family. I read Death of the Family. I read almost everything up until Year Zero, whatever it was called. I read almost up until
then. Yeah, that was kind of a little bit of a struggle there. It was a weird time.
Yeah, and then Batman Eternal started coming out, and I was like, I don't fucking get this timeline now. And then I was off put again, because there's like four different Batman series that go on from the start. Even there was Detective Comics, Batman. There's another Batman one, I forget. Arkham Knight,
Batman
or something,
and
maybe.
Robin.
And Batman then and Robin.
Dark Knight.
And then Dark Knight, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, well, that's, I don't know. But then I just picked
you
up
You don't
Snyder's.
Have to read them all.
I don't have to, but like, yeah. I just feel like I need to, because I'm like, but they all say Batman. I should know all about, I don't understand why there's four comics of Batman. Like, is it the same? I thought this was the same universe now. Like, I just didn't fucking get it. And I was, instead of me taking the time to either decide I'm not going to figure this out and I'm just going to continue to read, or take the time and read them all and do the research and do all that stuff, which involves a lot of labor, and I don't want to do labor. I don't want to have to work for my meal. And so I just didn't.
America.
I just didn't. Yeah, no. I mean, again, I know that I'm wrong, because I'm looking at it from the wrong perspective that I should. I should either go in and say, fuck it, and just pick what I want to read and hope for the best, and if I see something that I don't understand, just let it be. But for me, I'm neurotic, and I can't do it. I can't do that. And so I just sort of have to either...
It's like this weird balance of neuroticism and laziness, where you're just like, I have
Correct.
To know everything, but I'm
yes.
not going to put in the work to do it.
Absolutely.
Jeff!
Absolutely. Like, I want to know everything, but like, it's not the Matrix yet, so I can't just have it inputted and input in my brain, where I don't know Kung Fu that quickly. You know, like, I just...
Oh my gosh.
Again, I know that I'm wrong, but I won't change.
Oh God. What did I walk into?
That is American.
That is amazing.
I know who I am. I know what's wrong with my choices when it comes to comics, but I still stand by the fact that in some sort of weird fashion, some sort of silver lining in this whole thing, I am right.
All right, man. All right, wow. Man.